This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about how one of San Luis Obispo County's largest employers is being hurt by the pandemic shutdown.
Every category of business that we serve has been impacted by this in basically every region of the world at once. I couldn't have dreamed this scenario up a month and a half ago.
Also, we'll learn about Fort Hunter Liggett's response to COVID-19.
Our first and foremost responsibility is the protection of our workforce and protection of our military.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. MindBody is a health and wellness technology company headquartered in San Luis Obispo, with offices in Santa Maria and around the world. While the current stay-at-home situation may be good for some tech companies like Zoom, for MindBody this is not the case. Late last week, the company announced it was laying off or furloughing 35% of its workforce. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke with CEO and co-founder Rick Stollmeyer.
Our business has been deeply impacted by COVID-19 because our customers, these studios, spas, salons, wellness centers that we serve, have, as everyone is well aware, been almost simultaneously shut down by the virus mitigation efforts, by social distancing, quarantine, and shelter at home. And so we've seen that our business owner customers are really suffering. And the volume of activity on our platform, the sources of revenue that we earn, has been just driven way down. And roughly two-thirds of the revenue that we were counting on for Q2 isn't there. And it won't be there until the virus is really beaten. And of course, that could be months.
What are you doing right now? How do you spend your days? What kind of decisions are you making right now?
Well, it's like I was just talking with one of our other execs. It's like one long day that just won't end for the last 3 or 4 weeks. You know, the magnitude of the crisis really started emerging for us in early March, like it did for everyone else. And so what we've been doing is just trying to figure out what our new baseline is for revenue, and then understand how much cash losses we can manage and maintain a viable business out the other end of this. And so that led us to some extraordinary cost-cutting efforts. We did everything we could to reduce costs in our business, cancel nice-to-haves. We trimmed back on some of our benefits. We canceled bonuses. We even cut pay, and even after that, it just wasn't enough. We just had to cut headcount. So we have laid off or furloughed globally about 700 people. That's 35% of our workforce.
Here in San Luis Obispo County, of course, you guys are one of the largest employers. So what does that mean for San Luis Obispo County?
So San Luis Obispo County. We really consider the San Luis Obispo office and the Santa Maria office together. You know, it's mostly the SLO office, roughly 200 and change, maybe 250.
Okay.
And so it's that are furloughed or laid off. And the difference is the furloughs are the people we hope to bring back within 60 to 90 days as we project that our business will start recovering. But we also don't believe that our business will fully recover for more than a year. So that's why we also have layoffs, just permanent layoffs.
The aid package that Congress passed last week, a lot of people were critical of that, saying that perhaps the money would have been better spent going directly to employers to keep them on the payroll. How do you feel about that? Do you find that was true? Like, if you would have gotten more aid from the federal government, would that have changed the picture for you?
Well, we didn't get any aid in the federal government, you know, because we're not, there were two categories of businesses that got some kind of relief or aid. The first is, of course, very special categories of business, big business like airlines, who got relief packages, and then, of course, smaller businesses. And, of course, we're very much in favor of the aid. We actually helped lobby for some of that for the smaller business owners. And so I think the best thing that they've done is to have these government guaranteed loans that if you keep your staff employed, then the loan is forgivable. That's how I understand it. I'm not an expert on the legislation as it was finally crafted last week. If that's the case, then that's a very good thing. But if it's just a loan, no business owner is going to borrow money to keep people employed if they don't have, if they have to pay it back, to be just perfectly blunt about it, because most small business owners don't have that much of a reserve. And so I think that, you know, it's interesting, other countries have done things where they literally are paying the businesses to keep people employed. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And so the UK, you know, we have offices in addition to the United States in the UK and Australia, and they've done some things there. But there really wasn't much of anything in that package that directly helps mind body. What there is and what we're grateful for are things that can help some of our customers stay afloat during the crisis.
I see, because you're not a small business.
No, we have 2,000 employees, or I should say we have 2,000 employees right now going down. We're now going to be having active, you know, after Friday we'll be 1,300 employees.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to Greta Mart speaking with MindBody CEO and co-founder Rick Stollmeyer. Let's get back to their conversation.
When I first started thinking about it, I thought, oh, well, it's technology. Why are they hurt when everyone's going online? You think that technology businesses are all doing well, but I didn't consider that most of your clients, they depend on the getting together in person kind of thing, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, we're talking about fitness studios, spas, salons, wellness and integrative health centers. Every category of business that we serve has been impacted by this in basically every region of the world at once. I couldn't have dreamed this scenario up a month and a half ago. And, you know, we started realizing that that there could be a serious problem in February. You know, when the COVID virus started hitting the news and we're watching it in China, and we started preemptively holding back on expenses. You know, we actually froze hiring. We started cutting back on nice to haves as ways to reduce our expenses. But, you know, as the full extent of this really kind of coalesced in our minds, it's interesting, I've talked to different people and curious if you feel the same way. It was kind of that week of March 9th, where if you try to go back in time, it seems like such a long time ago, but go back and look at your calendar and think about where you were, where your mindset was on Monday, March 9th, and where was your mindset a week later?
Right.
On Monday the 16th. That week was when I think for so many of us, the true magnitude of this really hit. And We have the ability to see what's happening across all of our customers, all 60,000 of them around the world. And we saw in February we were seeing, you know, China and Hong Kong being impacted. In mid-March, it just suddenly, like, every one of our regions that just fell off a cliff. It was shocking. It's unprecedented. You know, this business started this business in my garage in the wake of the dot-com collapse in the early, you know, in 2000, 2001. Early days of the business went through 9/11, directly impacted many of our customers in New York, and also the recession that accompanied that. And then, of course, the financial crisis of 08, 09, and 10. This is nothing like that. This is worse than all three of those things combined times five. It's much for our business, much harder. There is some good part of this story, that is that a remarkable number of these studios and business owners, you know, they're really scrappy, determined, innovative people, and they're all in. And they have moved to a virtual delivery model. So using everything from Zoom meetings like this meeting, or Facebook, or WhatsApp, FaceTime, any mechanism by which they can stay connected to their clientele. And thousands of them are doing it now. And it's remarkable to see. And we've accelerated our own virtual wellness business platform to help them do that better. We had it in development for several months, and about a month ago, realizing that, hey, this might become an urgent need, we stepped on the gas. And so I'm really pleased to report that we're releasing that product this week. And it's going to enable more of our customers to deliver classes and appointments virtually. But there are a lot of things you can't do virtually. Someone can't do your hair virtually, and they can't give you a massage virtually, or various other kinds of wellness treatments. So it's a partial solution for some businesses, and it will help mitigate the pain to some extent. But you know, I want to make sure I'm not sugarcoating it. It's really tough for our customers right now.
I don't have any other questions. Anything else that I haven't asked you that you want to get out to the Central Coast community this time?
Just that we remain highly committed to the Central Coast. This is still our global headquarters. The layoffs and furloughs were a global phenomenon, proportionally affect our team here locally. But we still have between San Luis Obispo and Santa Maria, we still have 900 active employees, and we remain highly committed to the region.
Okay. All righty. And do you feel at all optimistic?
I think the next few months are going to be tough for everyone. And I think that human beings are resilient. And I think we will come out of this crisis. I think the combination of our unified effort to beat this virus and science, and our of course, renewed respect for public health and our healthcare workers, is all going to produce a lot of very good things for us in the long term. You know, public health was a pretty boring topic 2 months ago. It's not going to be ever again in our lifetime. And I think that's exciting. I think there's an opportunity for us to transcend the kind of just bickering that we've all been in the last few years, and realize our commonality. You can't build a wall high enough to keep a virus out. And we are truly connected globally in every way, you know, physically and economically and health-wise and environmentally. And so I'm really optimistic about that. And I believe our economy will reshape itself. I think that restaurants and bars and coffee shops and fitness studios and salons and spas will always be an important part of our lives. And our rally cry to our customers is, hang in there, you know, hunker down through this crisis, do what you can to bring in what revenue you can. And because when we come out the other end of this, we're all going to be incredibly hungry for human contact, because this whole virtual thing kind of sucks. So I don't think that there'll ever be, I'm not buying into the notion that physical fitness and wellness is going to be now a purely virtual phenomenon. That doesn't make any sense to me. So I am long-term optimistic, both about humanity, about our economy, and about the industry we serve.
Okay, that's good to hear. All right, Rick. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Greta. You take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was MindBody CEO and co-founder Rick Stolmeyer speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County is the U.S. Army Reserve's largest training installation. It is also a remote community with specific actions being taken during the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. Our conversation is with Colonel Charles Bell, commander at Fort Hunter Liggett. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. I know this is a busy time for you.
Hey, thank you, Carol. We appreciate the opportunity, and it's always good to
to let everybody know what we're doing out here at Fort Hunter Liggett, and that our number one priority is to take care of our Fort Hunter Liggett community.
I want to first sort of paint a picture for those of us who have not been to Fort Hunter Liggett, or, you know, who maybe haven't been there in a long time.
We're the eighth largest installation at 165,000 acres. And we're comprised of two installations. So the United States Army Garrison Fort Hunter Liggett is comprised of Fort Hunter Liggett, the installation, and then the Parks Reserve Forces Training Area in Dublin, California, which is in the San Francisco area. And so both of those installations make up United States Army Garrison Fort Hunter Liggett.
I want to talk about how the COVID-19 virus has impacted just the function of Fort Hunter Liggett on a daily basis.
So as we talk about COVID-19, we have to go back and look at what we consider our health protection condition. And our health protection condition here at Fort Hunter Liggett is Charlie. And what that means is that we have mission essential personnel only. And so as you walk through the garrison or run through the garrison, as I do predominantly every morning, you'll see that there's a lot less people. And that's because roughly 25% of our personnel are considered mission essential. And so the other 75% are teleworking or on some type of administrative or leave status. So there's a lot less people than you usually see, you know, operating in and around Fort Hunter Liggett.
You mentioned the health protection condition. Can you just explain to us what Charlie means? I assume it's the third level up of something.
Yes, ma'am. So Alpha is the first level. Bravo's a more heightened level. And then Charlie, we start moving into an environment in which it's probable that the virus may be present and be able to be spread. So because of that, our precautionary measures go up. So if you were to come through the front gate under Alpha or Bravo, it's, I wouldn't say business as usual, but the screening procedures aren't as evasive as they are now. So if you come through at Charlie, we're getting a temperature reading on you. We're asking you a series of questions. If you are at risk at all, you're not admitted access to the garrison. And so we really, really, really try to make sure that we're protecting our workforce. The second thing is that we always enforce social distancing in any of our meetings. If you were here in the room with us today, you would see that we're not sitting on top of each other. We're, you know, 6 feet apart. And any meeting that we hold within the garrison, everybody adheres to social distancing guidelines. So when I go into our operations center in the morning at 09 for our daily update, everybody is scattered about, which is provides a different feel for sure. And then we also open a teleconference line. We, of course, have some of our folks that are out teleworking. And then we have others within the headquarters here that just dial in. That way we don't have everybody in the same room all at the same time. Here in the headquarters, we try to make it a point because there's myself, my deputy commander, Lieutenant Colonel Jason McKenzie, and then the deputy to the garrison commander, Mr. Dave Myers, Command Sergeant Major Flukiger as well. So we make up the command team of the garrison, so we don't ever want to be centrally located in the same area. Those are some of the precautionary measures we've taken across the garrison as we talk about protecting our workforce and how we can ensure that we're carrying out the daily business of the garrison in the most distributed manner possible. We can safeguard everybody from the virus.
I hear a lot about the training exercises. 12,000 people at a time will be there. What have you done with the training exercises?
So as a platform, what we do here is we provide base operation support for those exercises. So the senior leaders in our Army have made a decision based on the current health protection condition status to postpone major collective training exercises. So typically, around the May timeframe, we will have our big Army Reserve exercise, which is CSTX or Combat Support Training Exercise is the official name for it. And if you know anything about the military, we like to give everything an acronym. So it's abbreviated CSTX. So that exercise that typically takes place in May will now take place in July. And then in conjunction with that, we already had templated a exportable combat training capability exercise in support of our National Guard partners. And that was originally scheduled for August. At this point, there's been no shift of that exercise, so that'll still take place. There were some other exercises that support our other DoD partners, such as the naval construction elements in Port Hueneme. They come up and they train at our installation on a pretty regular basis, and they've had to postpone their training. And so at some point, we think the conditions will subside and we'll be on the tail end of this thing. And we expect that our training load will be quite large with a lot of units trying to make up for missed opportunities.
It sounds like you're doing what just about every business, gosh, possibly, you know, at least in the United States, maybe the world, what we're all doing right now, taking a wait-and-see attitude, canceling what needs to be canceled, postponing.
That's exactly what we're doing. Our first and foremost responsibility is the protection of our workforce and protection of our military, and bringing large elements of those formations into Fort Hunter Liggett now would not be good based on our current COVID environment. I will tell you that there is training that still occurs at Fort Hunter Liggett. We have quite a bit of aerial training, which if you were here today, you would see fighter aircraft flying in our airspace. They do maneuvers over Fort Hunter Liggett because we have restricted airspace. We own the airspace. We also have a gunnery, aircraft gunnery from AC-130 from Moffett Field that flies down, and they're doing targeting practice over the course of the next couple of days. Of course, they fly in, execute their training, and then fly back home, so they're not coming in to the garrison.
Some things can go on as usual.
Yes, ma'am. And then in addition to that, we have what I'll call mission essential training. That is training that supports mobilization and contingency. So if a unit is scheduled for a deployment and they have training that was templated to be executed and it will deter or delay their deployment, they are still authorized to do that training. And so we will support that training. And also, you know, there's another caveat. We have Title 32 units. When I say Title 32, those are National Guard units. And so they operate somewhat different rule set, but they follow the same DOD and Army guidance. But there's a little more latitude to conduct collective training. As you see in the news, the National Guard is deploying all over the state of California. Occasionally, they have to come together to really flush out some things and get some training done. Again, it's in support of a mobilization, maybe not a contingency mobilization to go overseas. We'll support those type of events and activities.
We are hearing about the National Guard being dispatched to respond to, you know, civil issues. And what is the Army Reserve doing?
Yeah, so the Army Reserve's response to COVID-19 is to provide a formation called an Urban Augmentation Medical Task Force. So in support of the Urban Augmentation Medical Task Force, predominantly made up of practitioners that go into metropolitan areas and support non-COVID-related cases. So those medical providers in the local area will be available to support COVID. So we have two rotations of the task force that are deploying to Parks Reserve Force training area, and they're going to prepare for their deployment.
Fort Hunter Liggett has emergency responders. Do they sometimes help support in with local situations?
That's another good point. We do have emergency responders. We do have mutual aid agreements. And quite often, Fort Hunter Liggett is used as a staging area for CAL FIRE and the National Forest, who are two of our larger mutual aid partners. But then we also have local community partners as well. And so if there is a need for immediate response, we will provide that if they can't provide it and they request us to, under our mutual aid agreement. If they need something in response to COVID, they'll have to go through the county, the state, and FEMA, and then from there they'll figure out what that response will look like and where it'll come from.
Okay. I saw a video, and it was your emergency response center being shown. Long rows of tables, lots of people huddled together, figuring things out, looking at big screens. Everyone had a job to do. Pretty close quarters. What does that room look like now? I imagine it looks different.
Yeah, it does. So as you saw in the video, that operations center is where we do our morning updates, and it looks much different now. There's probably, you know, three people on each row of those tables as you look
right
down the big line of tables.
Yeah.
But you did bring up a good point about our full-scale exercise. That's been something that we focused on, doing some type of tabletop full-scale exercise. We do a full-scale exercise, a full-blown full-scale exercise once a year. But every quarter we do some type of refresh on on that with a tabletop or a staff training exercise that really reinforces emergency response.
What does a tabletop exercise look like? Is it what I'm visualizing? What our listeners, what we're all thinking when we think tabletop?
Yeah, it is, except that we've replaced the tables of the 1950s with PowerPoint slides. So, term tabletop was coined back before we had PowerPoint, and we would lay out the existing common operating picture on a table, and people would take turns based on their response to a situation or a condition. Now we put all that on PowerPoint. So that's essentially what a tabletop is. It's just an exercise to walk through current conditions and understand, you know, where the friction points are, what we need to get synchronized on, and really just make sure we're all working together as a team. Part of what has resulted with COVID is we've gone back and collectively put together a response plan that really, really is supporting our installations. If we were to have a incident of COVID on the installation, our teams would know exactly what to do. And when I say teams, that's because we have predominantly three teams. We have the operations center, and then we have what's called Team Trace, that would identify the COVID suspect and identify, you know, where they've been and who they've had contact with. Then we have a team called Team Trace, and that's essentially what they do. Then we have a team called Team Clean that we've named Team Clean that will come behind and sterilize wherever they were. So if they were riding in a vehicle, you know, let's say a GSA van or a passenger van, Team Clean will come behind and make sure that they sanitize the van. And then we have Team Support, which is made up of our chaplain contingent here on the garrison, which while they're quarantined, waiting test results, the chaplains will make sure that they're taken care of. They receive the support that they need. If they need groceries or whatever that support is, the chaplain will coordinate that, or the chaplain's office will coordinate that support for the individual or the family. That entire process we worked through in the operations center as our response to COVID, and we've had to exercise it several times. I will tell you that we've had 9 people with symptoms, but they've all been tested and they're negative because they've had probably flu-like symptoms or the common cold or, but COVID's hard to detect. I mean, you know, you just can't look at somebody and say, hey, well, you know, it's the flu or it's a common cold. So we have to take every one of those cases seriously in order to protect our community.
Yes.
And then we continuously are reinforcing the CDC guidelines, and that we want everybody to make sure that they're washing their hands and really monitoring their social distancing and staying safe.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's continue with our conversation with Colonel Charles R. Bell, commander at Fort Hunter Liggett. Colonel Bell, I want to talk for a minute about the base. And it is a community. People live there. There are families. People work there. You've got a recreation center, a bowling alley, pizza. How are the people who are living on the base, the families, how are they holding up?
Thanks for the question. Just recently, I talked to our chaplains, and I've charged our chaplains to get out and visit our family housing communities. And the one thing that they're telling me is that our folks are incredibly resilient. They are well-informed. They follow us on social media. We did a Facebook Live town hall, and then we did a couple of teleconference town halls to really keep them updated. And we have to do that because I think you talked about some of the services that we have on the installation, such as the bowling alley and the recreation center and the gymnasium, and we've had to close those. And so the only services that remain open now are our post exchange, our commissary, and the bowling alley and the subway on the installation support takeout only. And we've had to do that just to again, safeguard our community. And then within the PX and the commissary, as well as the bowling alley and subway, we've enforced more stringent sanitation requirements. So we've asked the managers of those facilities, you know, every hour on the hour, before opening, before closing, really sanitize the community spaces. And I think that's really paid dividends for us. But it has somewhat restricted life here on Fort Hunter Liggett.
I know you have a new high-tech training school. Are you using that in a different way right now?
Yeah, so the high-tech training school that you're referring to is the Army school system. The Army school system, it's ran by the 80th Training Command, who is our training partner here at Fort Hunter Liggett. And currently, because of what we're doing as a nation, and there are the travel restrictions in place by the Department of Defense, currently we graduated our last class last week. They were authorized to travel home, but no new classes are arriving. So, like we had talked about earlier, we're following suit with the rest of the nation and making sure we're doing our part. We definitely wouldn't want to bring a group of folks from across the United States, and so we're just doing our small part of that.
I saw a reference to a phrase, stay connected, stay engaged, stay calm, and stay safe. I have one last question. Many of us, myself included, are having a hard time while we shelter in place, just keeping a schedule, keeping going with the work that we need to do. Do you have any advice that you could offer?
Well, first and foremost, our heartfelt condolences for anybody that's lost a loved one to COVID-19. And, you know, I urge everybody to continue to stay vigilant and follow the CDC guidelines. What we've done, in addition to downsizing our workforce and going to mission essential personnel only, is really to our telework community. Those are folks that are working from home and their day is a little monotonous. I even go back to my son that's a high schooler and he's taking classes online and he's at home nonstop. You know, part of having that resiliency means you have to get out, you have to do some exercise and get your heart rate up, and you can stay active, just stay active in a manner in which keeps you separated from everybody else. So I think that's one thing that I try to encourage as the commander of Fort Hunter Liggett. We've instituted within our morning meetings, we have a exercise of the day to our teleworking community and our families out there. We need to make sure that we're doing other things. We're keeping our mind in other places, and part of that is through daily movement and exercise and getting out and about.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Colonel Bell, commander at Fort Hunter Liggett, joining us here at KCBX for Issues and Ideas. Thank you so much, and our best to you all at Fort Hunter Liggett.
Hey, thank you, Carol. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Colonel Charles Bell, commander at Fort Hunter Liggett in southern Monterey County. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. When we return, we'll get a firsthand account of what it's like to be on the front lines of medicine during a pandemic. And we will hear from a first-time local author.
I just sat down and wrote my first chapter just free. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going.
Those stories coming up on Issues and Ideas. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman. What's it like to be on the front lines of a pandemic? Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel got a firsthand account from Dr. Patil Armenian. She's an associate professor of clinical emergency medicine at UCSF Fresno, and she works at Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno.
Why don't you take us through the ER? You know, what is it like right now? I've heard some people say it's kind of like the calm before the storm.
We are really talking about it right now, like it is the calm before the storm, because we're used to really high volumes of people. Typically in our emergency department, we see, I believe, over 325 patients a day. And those numbers are really cut down right now, I think, because people really don't want to come in if they're not, they don't really need to come to the ER. And so although we're experiencing really low volumes, all of our colleagues, you know, north and south of us and across the country, they're already experiencing, you know, major surges, as we all know. So in our ER right now, the busiest parts of our ER are our tent, where we do COVID-19 screening, and actually our high acuity areas. So those, that means the areas of our ER where we see the sickest patients.
And you said you were working in the high acuity area last night. Tell me what was that like?
I was there last night, and what I really liked about my shift was just seeing everybody working really well together. We've always been a really good team, which is one of the reasons why I work at CRMC. I love all of our nurses and techs and clerks and all of our ancillary staff, and we always work like a really tight-knit unit. But last night it was even more so because we were all getting dressed at the same time in full protective wear to go into all of our really sick cases, and then always, you know, debriefing afterwards anytime we had a really critical case. And so it was actually really nice to just, you know, realize, you know, we're all on the same team here and we're gonna get through this. And we did see a lot of sick people, people that, you know, we're ruling out for COVID-19 and may have it, but we were able to kind of really function well together as a team. And most of it is because our department has really done a lot of preparation.
Well, what are some of the fears ER doctors and nurses have about preparedness for this pandemic?
You know, our fears are on so many levels. We have fears for our patients, right? That we're not going to have enough equipment to take care of them. We have fears for ourselves and our families that we're going to get infected and then take it home to our families and get the people that we love sick, or get sick and critically ill or die ourselves. And so that comes with the fear of not having adequate protective gear. You know, what if we run out, or running out of things that we need to take care of our patients, running out of space in which to keep our patients. So it's really many different levels of fear. And so you just have to take each one, you know, one thing at a time and see, okay, how can we prepare for this? How can we deal with this? And I think we're all doing, you know, many different things just on a personal level, but also on like a hospital and departmental level to deal with all of these things. So I think one thing that we're really good at in emergency medicine is just to, you know, come up with plans and getting things done. And so we're doing a lot to like get adequate protective gear for everyone in our department, to, you know, figure out what resources we have in our hospital and in our area that we could pull from, to make sure we have enough medications, and just like a lot of fear. But at the same time, you're like, okay, I'm gonna, just going to take each fear and figure out how do we deal with this. So for example, you know, the fear of bringing the disease home into your family. Well, I think every single doctor, nurse, ER staff that I know at this point, we all kind of, we strip down out of all of our clothes outside of our homes and then just walk straight into the shower, hot shower when we get home, and just scrub. So we all know none of your clothes and shoes come inside your house, for example, and kind of things like that. Like, so, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You have a family, obviously. Do you have children?
Yeah, I have a 2.5-year-old.
So what is that sort of disconnect like for you, going from this sort of crisis situation to coming home to this, I'm sure, adorable toddler?
Yeah, he has no idea what's going on in the world. He just thinks that we're on a really long vacation right now. And it's hard because he's not going to his preschool right now. And so when I'm not in the ER, I'm at home being mom so that my husband can work. And fortunately, he can work from home, but basically, if I'm not physically in the hospital, I'm taking care of my toddler so that he can do his job. So it's really tough, actually, and just constantly trying to, you know, be outside and stay relaxed and just stay calm and positive so that you don't let the stress and the magnitude of what's really going on, you know, get to you in the home.
And you were talking about preparedness. What is a specific example of how you might be gearing up to make sure you have enough equipment, like masks?
Well, our department, has been just buying up whatever gear we can find. So that's actually, it's not just our department, our whole hospital. So our hospital's been looking into like any source of masks and gowns and face shields and kind of anything you could think of. And they're just stocking up as much as possible. And then on a personal level, you know, I think a lot of us have also bought at least a few of our own N95 masks to have, just in case. I bought some online the other day just to have in case the hospital does run out. But I think right now, right now we're doing okay, but you know, we're also conserving a lot. So for example, before you would wear a mask, see one patient, throw that mask away. Those days are gone. Usually you have one mask for an entire shift. And really you kind of shouldn't be using more than that, or else we will run out.
And ER doctors see everything from shootings to horrific car crashes to domestic abuse cases, but this situation is exceptional. I'm wondering, what are ER doctors saying to each other? What are your conversations like?
Our conversations right now revolve a lot about, at least right now, because in Fresno, it hasn't hit us with the giant tsunami wave like it has in New York City, for example. So right now, a lot of our conversations with each other center around preparedness and protection. And so whether that's constantly reminding each other of, like, you know, don't forget to put your mask, like leave your mask on, or, you know, wash your hands, and just kind of things like that, to just to the bigger stuff of like talking to each other about how, you know, what we're doing at, you know, at home to stay safe, or what we're doing to prepare, what our department is doing, how we can contribute to that. So that's kind of where we're at right now. And then we're also, ER doctors are really good storytellers. And so everybody is talking to their friends and colleagues in different parts of the country, then coming back and telling each other the stories of, this is what my buddy in New York said, or this is what's happening there, this is what they're seeing. And so we're just, that's like also a lot of our conversations of, you know, my friend in New York intubated 19 patients on his night shift, and kind of things like that, of like, these are the stories going around amongst our friends and colleagues.
And, you know, speaking of those stories, a lot of people are calling doctors and nurses heroes right now, and with good reason. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think nurses, doctors, are, you know, techs and pharmacists and everyone that works on the front line in that space, in that physical space, is a hero, because they're exposing themselves to a potentially, you know, deadly disease, and still showing up for work, doing a good job, being great teams together, and really, you know, helping people when they need it the most. So I firmly believe that anybody in the emergency department setting is a hero just for walking into that place and doing their job.
Well, Dr. Armenian, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me. Thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
That was Dr. Patil Armenian with Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel. Jessica Winters Morales is a first-time novelist, and she found an alternative route to getting her book published. Morales shares her story with KCBX correspondent Brian Reynolds.
Today, we are joined by local novelist, first-time novelist, Jessica Winters Morales. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have a very interesting background. We're going to talk about your book, Lost in Oaxaca. But tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got from one career to another.
Well, I have spent most of my career as a piano teacher and musician. I did a little writing in college, but as a music major, I figured that was the career path I was going to go. And so I started teaching piano, got married, raised four children. And then when my youngest daughter was 2.5, she was diagnosed with leukemia, with cancer. So that kind of stopped everything in its tracks, and our lives changed dramatically, and we started looking at life differently. And I decided that, I was going to do what I wanted to do my whole life, which was write. I always dreamed about it. I constantly wrote in my head while I was doing other things. And I thought, I'm finally going to do what I want to do. So I started writing. I started small. I took an adult education class. I started blogging. I joined a writer's group. And after having a little success, I published a few things. I decided to write a novel. And I did it.
It's a cliche that we all have a book inside of us, perhaps a novel, perhaps a history. But most of us don't get there, or when we do get there, we get rejection slips from the publishers. But was your family supportive of you carving out enough time to sit down and write every day, or how did that work?
Well, luckily, with my own career as a piano teacher, I didn't normally start teaching until the afternoon, until after school. So I had a few mornings free. And so I would use that time. And yes, my family was very supportive. My husband especially encouraged me to do it. Why don't you go sit down and write something? He'd nag me literally to go do it because I'd talked about it for so long. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of doing it every day. And that's why I tell my piano students, you just need to practice a little every day and be consistent. And if you're consistent, you get something done. And it starts to happen.
Are you the type of person who outlined the plot and the characters?
Absolutely not. I just sat down and wrote my first chapter just free. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going. And subsequent chapters just sort of unfolded. I had no idea what was happening, what was going to happen. And it just sort of unfolded. And it was really interesting. It was a very interesting process. Maybe the next novel I'll do it differently, but this one was just that way.
I know there's an additional element here that we had talked about earlier, and that is you got associated with a group called She Writes Press.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, She Writes Press is an indie press, and it's also called a hybrid publisher. You do have to invest in it. You have to put up some money, and you have to be part of the process. But they give you so much guidance, and they help you, and they also take a chance on unknown people. And mm-hmm. that is really my experience, because I'm a middle-aged woman. I don't have a brand. I don't have a marketing platform. Nobody really cares about a middle-aged woman who wrote a book.
Do you have an agent?
No, I don't have an agent. Ah. So basically, they took a chance on me, and they were the only ones, because I must have queried, I hate to admit this, but it was probably over 100 publishers and agents. And while I got some bites, I had one agent who held onto the book for a year, a reputable New York agent. She liked it, and she kept it for a year, and I kept emailing her and saying, what's going on? And finally she said, I really like it, but I don't love it enough to take it on. So mm-hmm. you can't rely on that. Publishing is changing so much these days.
Right. In traditional publishing, you had a front, mid, and backlist. I mean, for most publishers, mm-hmm. that wasn't always true, say, in the science publishers, but fiction, poetry, a lot of things, cookbooks.
Right.
Anyways, you had your bestsellers at the front, and then your middle sellers, and the ones that were the old chestnut really didn't make any money.
Right.
But they used the profits of the bestsellers, the front list, to cross-subsidize the breadth of their,
yes.
of their portfolio. My concern is, in the e-publishing world, the costs are way down. But one wonders if publishers are going to use those profits to cross-subsidize physical books or more worthy books.
Anybody can write a book now. I mean, everybody does write. And you can self-publish and you can sell it on Amazon, and sometimes it takes off. And so you kind of have to learn as you go. And
right.
that's what I've been doing.
Lost in Oaxaca, broadly speaking, is about a piano teacher who has certain challenges. And she goes to Mexico on a mission of not really mercy, but help one of her students show up for a performance. And all kinds of things happen. How much of this, of the novel, that mirrors your own life?
I am a pianist and trained as a musician. So that, of course, is where I write from. And so there's quite a few things. And she goes to Mexico. I have a connection to Mexico, too, because my husband is Oaxacan. He's an indigenous Zapotec from Oaxaca. So I had that to rely on to write the story. And I've always found his culture so beautiful and fascinating that it was just easy for me to write about it. We've traveled to Oaxaca many times. We have family there. And, there are things that have happened to my protagonist, Camille, that never happened to me. But some did. Some of the experiences were real.
There's a theme in the book about the lack of knowledge between the two neighbors, U.S. and Mexico. I see the novel and your efforts as a way to teach us, not just to entertain, but to teach us about our neighbors to the south in ways that will raise up both cultures. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, my protagonist goes to Mexico as a privileged white woman. She does have suffering in her life. She injured her fingers. She had to give up a career as a concert pianist because of this injury. And so she's devoted all her time to grooming this young Oaxacan girl who lives in the Santa Barbara to become this pianist that she never got to be. So this is really important for her to have this concert happen because it's going to give her the recognition that she's always dreamed of. So she goes to Mexico with these ideas about Mexico and Mexican people, but she goes there and finds a completely different story, that these people are wonderful, that the culture is amazing, the food is incredible, the arts and everything. And she just, this whole world opens up to her and she starts to view things differently. I mean, every town has its own like mini culture where they have dancing and food and celebrations that they do specific to that town. And so that comes into the novel, too, where Camille travels to this mountainous village, which happens to be the village that my husband is from. And when Camille goes to this this town, she is just welcomed and loved and treated so beautifully. And it's a shame that we don't treat immigrants the same way in this country. You know, we have some real problems with that.
You mention in the book a very real phenomenon that tourism and movement of people across the Mexico-U.S. border is largely unidirectional. That is, you or I can, I want to go to Mexico City. There's an exhibit at the museum. Yeah. We just get a ticket and go with a passport. But they have to get visas to travel, and in many cases, not available. In fact, lack of a visa has an important element in your plot.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I can go to Mexico anytime I want. I have family members in Oaxaca who cannot come visit us in this country because they can't get visas, because they aren't wealthy, they don't have connections. It's just impossible. They would never be able to do that.
Is it fair to say that wealthier people in Mexico, wealthier Mexicans have an easier time getting visas than others?
Absolutely.
There is a character in the book that shows the dark side and that exists in Mexico and also in the gang environment here in California. I found your portrait of that is chilling.
Well, this is what happens, is that these families have immigrated from this small village, which is a very small village in Oaxaca. And there's a huge community of these people who live in Los Angeles. And they do the same things in the culture in Los Angeles that they do back in this village. Well, a lot of these kids that were brought to this, or were born here in Los Angeles, get involved in gang culture. You know, it's sad. And then they take it back to this village. So it ends up back in this tiny little community.
Like an infection.
Yeah, it really does. And all the problems that we have with gangs in Los Angeles end up in this small little town, too.
I'd like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Jessica Mireles, first-time novelist, and we're talking about her novel, Lost in Oaxaca, a very interesting read, which I highly recommend. We have talked before today about the importance of culture and the arts in the raising us up as a society, as a human race. Music is clearly one way to do that. Have you looked at some of the musical offerings down there, or are you familiar with some of those, whether it's folk music or...
Yeah.
I mean, Mexico has world-class everything.
They do.
Including symphonic stuff.
Everything. And the most interesting thing that I've encountered in my travels to this village of my husband's, which is called Villa Hidalgo Yalala, they have a huge symphonic band. They teach their children these musical instruments. They're passed down through the generations. And they play at all the festivities. These incredibly talented young musicians. And these bands are also in Los Angeles. They have the groups that come out to all the weddings and all the bautizos and quinceañeras and everything they do. They have these bands. So when I first time I heard it, I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't sound indigenous. This is like European music. And it was.
Right.
It's European. It's waltzes, and it was brought by the Spaniards when the Spaniards came to Mexico. And
the Germans.
And the Germans. And it's the influence is there. Uh-huh. And it's fascinating. It was really fascinating to me. So that's a part of the story, too. Camille is a musician herself, and she sees this, and she's just dumbfounded. She just doesn't understand it.
I mentioned earlier that there's a festival in, I'll call it my town, which is Compostela in Nayarit, up in the mountains near, above Puerto Vallarta in the mountains. And once a year they have a thank you ceremony to the saint that saved them from a cholera epidemic 150 years ago. And so for about 2 weeks there's events going on, children's parades and, you know, kind of like carnival things going on. But at the Central Plaza, you know, about as big as a football field maybe, mm-hmm. but more square, there's half a dozen of these dark-skinned Indian bands brass bands mm-hmm. playing, and you can walk around with a glass of rompope, which is eggnog.
Right.
And when you leave the strains of one band, you walk another 20 feet and you hear another one. It's not amplified.
Yeah.
So it's like, for me, I'm very much into music, it was like, oh my gosh, I get goosebumps even thinking about it. I wished I could put them all on a plane and bring them up here and have them play at the PAC. That's one of my dreams. Getting spiritual a little bit, I've always felt that societies like the Oaxacan or Zapotec societies, it's my view, they have a lot to teach us.
They do.
Spiritually, practically, emotionally. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, in the book, Camille is speaking with Alejandra, who ends up being a very big part of her life. And she says, I don't understand these people. Why do they have all these parties all the time? Why are they doing all this stuff? Why are they spending money they don't have? And he says, this makes them connect with each other. And that's really what it's all about, connection.
Tell us about where people can buy your book.
Okay.
Are there websites?
Yeah, I have a website, jessicawintersmorellis.com. And I also, the book will be available on April 21st. It's coming out. You can pre-order it on Amazon, or you can go to my website, and there are various ways to buy it. It'll be an interesting, fun trip for you to go on.
Well, I would like to remind everyone that this has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we were joined by first-time novelist Jessica Morellis, talking about her new book, Lost in Oaxaca, which goes on sale April 21st. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. It's at kcbx.org. Thank you for keeping us with you. We hope we're providing some companionship if you're sheltering at home, and essential information as we weather this pandemic together.